throughout the different verses of the Holy Quran, as well as the traditions and the transmitted supplications even. So one of the most important things that we need to discuss prior to discussing the concept of dua that we have partly mentioned is the fact that there are some obstacles that actually hinder the process of acceptance of prayer. So there are some obstacles, the acceptance of which might be detrimental to the supplicant, and the supplicant might not be aware of this. But Allah the Exalted knows this condition of the servant better than himself. So He subhanahu wa ta'ala knows what is good for him and what is bad. There are some other times the quick acceptance of prayer might be harmful for the supplicant. And Allah knows best that a delay in the response is better and more beneficial for the servant. So He subhanahu wa ta'ala withholds the acceptance of prayer for some times without nullifying or rejecting the prayer. So sometimes we might encounter the situations that our supplications are not being responded. But when we look deeper, when we look closer, when we look from another angle and perspective, we see that our supplication is responded, but not in the quickest way possible. It's not rejected. A phrase in the supplication of Iftitah reads and says, "So I became habituated to call you trustingly and ask you familiarly, neither fearing nor scared, pointing out to you that because of which I turned toward you." So this means that Allah the Exalted may delay in responding to the prayer of His servants so that He may prolong His standing and pleading before Him, as Allah loves the prolonged standing and entreating of His servants before Him.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
So, dear listeners, regarding أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ, we were discussing the concept of prayer, specifically the relation between da'a and also yujib. The Almighty Allah answers, and the servant calls. Now, what is the relationship between these two? So we said, when we want to fully discuss the concept of relation between these two, we need to take into our consideration the concept of obstacles. So we said that obstacles are of different types. Some of the time, we might not actually see that what we are calling for is detrimental for us, but the Almighty Allah knows. Sometimes, the quick response to our supplication might be detrimental, but the Almighty Allah knows. So, in this regard, sometimes we see that Allah the Exalted may delay in responding to the prayer of His servants, so that that servant may have more qiyam and more sujood, more pleading before Him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. According to a divine narration, Allah said to Prophet Musa, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, "O Musa, I am not neglectful of my creatures, but I love my angels to listen to the cry of the supplication rising from my servants." Also, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is narrated to have said, "It so happens that a servant makes supplication, and Allah the Almighty, the Majestic, says to the two angels, 'I have indeed answered him, but confine him to his needs, for I love listening to his voice.'" Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the sins. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Greetings, dear listeners, and a sincere thank you for joining us here on Iran Radio. We begin with another segment of radio productions. Next, we present Olema's speech. In this program, you'll hear excerpts from the original Farsi and Arabic lectures of esteemed Islamic and Shia scholars and authorities. Accompanied by English translation, it's a unique opportunity to hear directly from the scholars who shape our understanding of faith and practice. Then Radio Productions returns with more engaging content. Concluding this hour is Minbar. Up next is time for another segment of Radio Productions. Please stay with us.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam. Is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
Iyaka
na'budu. Intellect says, think, everyone else is transient, don't go elsewhere. May God have mercy on Martyr Mutahhari. Martyr Mutahhari had come to Kashan and I was in his company. He said to me, Mr. Qaraati, read this prayer every day. He said,
This prayer is for the month of Rajab, but you need to read it every day. The prayer is, "Fail are those who seek others than you, and lost are those who approach any but you."
إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ تَوَكَّلْ عَلَى الْحَيِّ الَّذِي لَا يَمُوتُ.
And put your trust in ever-living who never dies. All others will perish. Indeed, I will see the neglectful perish. The others will vanish and set like the sun. At the beginning of the prayer we praise, all praise is for Allah. Why? Because God is Lord of all the worlds. God is the most gracious. God is the most merciful. God is the master of the day of judgment. Well, if God is like this, then where else are you going? Cut your attachments to others. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Try to follow the signs. That's how I live my life. 'Cause when I lead it, my heart, it all goes wrong. My journey has been on time, but only for a short while. The road that I've been on is far too long, and the picture's never clear. So I can help to
cause I can't bleed no more. I wasn't born with a heart that's hollow.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by the tireless campaigning barrister, Frank McGuinness. Frank was born in Dublin, was raised in the occupied six counties in the north of Ireland, and was called to the Bar of England and Wales in 2016, practicing in the areas of criminal defence, civil law, and public law. He's worked against states, employers, and landlords, and has a particular expertise in claims relating to Palestinians and anti-Zionists in the struggle against Israeli colonialism and genocide. Thank you very much for joining me today, Frank.
Great to be here, comrade. Thank you for having me.
Well, you mentioned just now how this terrorism legislation is vague in terms of applying to state actors or non-state actors. So this legislation that we have in Britain and other parts of the world can be and is applied in some cases to state actors. In the case of Hamas, because it's the government of Gaza, you also have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has two government ministers. And you also now have this attempt to proscribe the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, even though they're a state actor. This proscription regime, this way of designating particular organizations as terrorists, needs to be talked about. Now, I've known you and I've known of your work for some years, and that's been a great privilege, but you have now gained fame or perhaps infamy in some
depends
circles.
Who you talk to.
Depends on who you talk to. For representing Hamas in their bid to be deprescribed, to be removed from the list of terrorist organizations in Britain. So they've put in an application for deprescription to the Home Secretary. What exactly is this prescription regime, and why, in your view, is it important for Hamas to be deprescribed?
Well, I think, again, history is helpful here, because you can't understand the Terrorism Act 2000 without understanding what you identified correctly was the precursor so-called emergency legislation that was deployed in the north of Ireland. So that was a domestic regime, right? It was designed to deal with the fact that within the territory of the so-called United Kingdom, there was a national liberation struggle. And quite, I would say quite a sophisticated one. Various very sophisticated groups like the Provisional IRA and the Irish National Liberation Army were fighting what they said was a war. Both of those organizations were, as far as they were concerned, armies fighting a decolonial, anti-colonial resistance campaign. And so the British state had this problem, which was within its own domestic jurisdiction, but, you know, in its oldest colony, there was a growing constituency of people who didn't want to be a colony of the British Empire and were willing to fight for their liberation, right? This sort of incomplete project of Irish national liberation. And so the problem is that when you're fighting an army, the Geneva Conventions apply and you treat your enemy combatants like they're soldiers in a war and you can intern them. And that's what Britain did in 1971, right? Operation Demetrius. They lifted thousands of Catholics out of their homes, often on the basis of really shoddy intelligence, and just didn't charge them or try them with any kind of criminal offences. It was wartime measures. And so the British Empire being the British Empire, they came up with some euphemism for what was effectively POW status. So they're like, we have to treat these people like POWs because we're treating them like POWs. We're treating them like combatants in a war, not charging them with any offences. So they came up with this euphemism, special category status, and then that leads to this escalation in the struggle, because having bestowed this status, they realised they were kind of bestowing the status of an army on their enemies. And so they tried to take it away. 1976, they get rid of prison uniforms. So they say you have to wear prison uniforms. and Republican prisoners refused. That led to the dirty protest, right? Because they weren't allowed to walk down the prison corridors to go to the bathroom without wearing a uniform. So that, hence the blanket men. So they were on the blanket, it was described as.
Yes, and this is the blanket protest, which took place over 5 years by Irish Republican political prisoners held at Longkesh prison.
Exactly. And then that escalates. 1980, first attempt at a hunger strike that's aborted. And then the second famous attempt, 1981, 10 men dead. But not before, crucially, Bobby Sands is elected to Parliament, right? And that's in response to this, again, this Thatcher policy of criminalisation, right? So it's like, you're just criminals, which is related, I think, to you're just terrorists, right? This is unacceptable, what you do. This your violence is unacceptable. When our British army goes around colonising half the world, that's fine and that's lawful. But when you fight against it, you're criminals and you're terrorists. So she was trying to, her government was trying to run this whole argument, this whole policy of saying you're all just thugs and criminals. And Bobby Sands obliterated that. At the age of 27, he completely obliterated her claim that you have no legitimacy, you're just thugs. And he went, well, how come I'm in your parliament? And then, may he rest in peace, he succumbed to his hunger strike. So that's really interesting history. I find British people and even British comrades on the left are insufficiently conversant with that history. But we in Ireland know our history, I think, much better. And we understand that 1981 was this pivotal turning point because it led to what Sinn Féin, right, the political wing of the Provisional IRA, described as the strategy of obtaining power with the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in the other, right? Infamous phrase. Armalite was a kind of machine gun that the IRA was fond of using. And you see something very similar in the Palestinian context, right? There's this idea that we'll win elections, but we're not going to disavow armed struggle. And like so many groups, there is a kind of non-military aspect of Hamas, and there is a military wing, right? And so, thinking about history, Tony Blair comes along and sort of presents himself as this peacemaker in the north of Ireland. And I would say I'm somewhat critical of some people in the north of Ireland who still have this funny little soft spot for Tony Blair because they thank him for the Good Friday Agreement, which is 1998, 1 year into his tenure. And so I think they're overly soft on Blair, and it's frankly a failure of international solidarity because, of course, we don't need to. It's staggeringly obvious that Blair was then responsible for horrific wars in the Middle East. He committed the crime of aggression for which war criminals were executed at Nuremberg. So this is kind of a meandering legal political history I'm offering here. But 1997, Blair's elected. 1998, Human Rights Act, Good Friday Agreement. And then 2000 is the Terrorism Act. So what's happening there? It's like he says, look, I'm gonna help to facilitate a peace treaty, Belfast Agreement or Good Friday Agreement in 1998, but then I'm going to consolidate what we found to be this very useful regime for dealing with terrorists in the north of Ireland, so-called terrorists in the north of Ireland, and I'm going to internationalize it. And then a year after that act is passed, a large number of groups get added to the list, including the military wing of Hamas. So throughout the Troubles, the British government, for all its flaws, observed a policy of saying, do you know what, we're not going to proscribe Sinn Féin. We're going to observe the distinction that the IRA tells us they observe between their military wing and their political wing. And we are going to accept that the politicians, people like Gerry Adams, are not engaged in armed struggle, but the military wing is. So it's illegal to be a member of the IRA, but it's not illegal to be a member of Sinn Féin. And I think the logic, it's clear, was that by making politicians illegal, you send a really disturbing message, right? Bobby Sands and then thereafter other people win election to your own parliament. They participate in your own so-called democratic process, but you say, we don't like who the Catholic population of the north of Ireland voted for, so we're going to make it illegal. It's just a terrible look, right? But I think partly through racism, but also partly because people winning election for the political wing of the IRA provokes a constitutional crisis in a so-called United Kingdom in a way that it doesn't in somewhere like Palestine. In 2021, Priti Patel made this astonishing decision to prescribe the political wing. So she departed from what had been this long-standing state policy in Britain of saying, well, whatever else we think of the armed wing, we're not going to prescribe the political wing. We're not going to start telling the people of Palestine that they voted for the wrong people, and so we're going to criminalize their political representatives. Like, that's a unabashed, full frontal assault on democracy. But it's not surprising. I think it's understated in the public discourse in a country like Britain around this stuff. Obviously, Iran is part of the picture here. We all saw those Iranian missile strikes after, you know, they were forced to defend themselves against an aggressive war that the Zionist entity launched against them. It is staggering to me how British people, British politicians, the British state dares to lecture the Iranians. When you think about that country's history, you think about the way that the British Empire, again, in a staggering affront to democracy, just said, oh, you voted for Mossadegh, wrong guy. We're going to, in a staggering affront to democracy, we're just going to impose the Shah because of the Persian, what was it called, Anglo-Persian Oil Company or whatever. Literally, we are engaged in colonial plunder, and we don't like that you've elected someone who's democratically about to nationalize our oil interests. So we're, you know, to hell with democracy. We're just going to replace him with our preferred candidate. So I don't think anyone who's paying attention expects the British Empire to care about democracy. Like, that would be ridiculous. I'm not trying to be nasty. It's just, it's silly. Like, the British Empire doesn't care about democracy.
Well, they're not silly enough, in a way, to believe in democracy, because they know that in order to preserve their interests, they can't rely on those interests being meaningfully changed through democratic means. So in many respects, we have a veil of democracy in many Western countries, not just Britain, but when it comes to fundamental interests and state policies, those can't meaningfully ever be changed through democratic processes.
Absolutely. It's so-called bourgeois democracy. It's not real democracy. And I'm not, again, I'm not saying that to be like idealistic or moralistic. I'm just like, what is democracy? It's about, you know, people having power. I would say workers having power. And workers don't have very much power at all in Britain. To the extent that we do, it's through the workplace, not through parliament. I think that there is economic democracy, which is the thing that most affects ordinary people, is power in their workplace, power over the thing that they spend most of their life doing, which is their job, right? Under capitalism, workers are coerced into selling their labor power for a wage so that they can pay for the things they need to live, like rent and food and all the rest of it. That is capitalism in a nutshell. That's the economic struggle. Hey, like, you're exploiting me. And if you paid me more, I would be more able to buy the things that I need. And then the political struggle is how these individual workplace struggles end up becoming aggregated in something like the state, right? So I have some friends who are anarchists, who are syndicalists, and I have a lot of respect and time for them, but I disagree with them because some of them would say, we should just focus on the economic struggle. We should just make a big union that fights bosses, and that's our strategy. And it's all well and good, but the point is, what do you do about the state, the problem of the state? So you want to organize in a workplace, you want to go on strike. You're going to encounter laws like the Trade Union Labor Relations Consolidation Act 1992, which remains the spine, in my opinion, of the British Constitution. It is more than anything else the consolidation of neoliberal class relations and the notion that it should be extremely difficult for workers to go on strike. So I don't have easy answers. I'm just one person. But it seems to me like there's a very interesting complex relationship between the economic and the political. And that takes us to the question of what is to be done about state power, what is to be done about democracy. And in a bourgeois country like Britain, they tell us, like, oh, you can choose between Labour and the Tories, and maybe if you're an idiot, you can vote for the Lib Dems, and imagine that that's something other than just throwing your vote away. But if, even with Jeremy Corbyn, who is, you know, a social democrat, some kind of liberal social democrat, believes in capitalism and believes in the Labour Party, oh, no, that's too much. And then you see the deep state coming out and attacking him, the media, even generals threatening to coup him, and the firing practice and stuff. So it's like the limits of democracy are laid bare. You can vote for everyone, anyone you want, so long as it's a person who believes in capitalism. But if it's someone who even believes in mild social democratic reform, like, you must not be allowed to have that. His own parliamentary party rebels against him. Everyone, you know, every part of the deep state rebels against him. And Ralph Miliband has a really good analysis of this, where he says, like, he's thinking about Allende and all the rest of it. Like, what's your strategy? You want to achieve socialism through a bourgeois parliament? Go on then. What's your strategy? Like, you understand that the judiciary, the military, the civil service, the press, like, everything is going to rebel against you because it's the bourgeois state and it's designed to advance bourgeois class interests. So as a socialist, what's your strategy for dealing with that? And he says something about, well, you just have to constantly mobilize. You have to constantly mobilize the working class and increase their participation.
But people are fickle, aren't they? I mean, even Ralph Miliband, and I like early Ralph Miliband, but even, you know, he, after writing Parliamentary Socialism, in which he savagely attacks the idea of achieving change through the Labour Party in Parliament, gets sucked into the idea of Parliamentary Socialism because Tony Benn, a great stalwart of the British left, becomes Minister of Technology. And apparently this is the great advance of the left. And so everyone starts saying, oh, now we have the opportunity to actually administer state power. We never thought we'd get here. Now we're here. And the same sort of thing happened with Jeremy Corbyn, right? So people spent lots of time on the left in Britain thinking we've got to organise outside of the Labour Party, outside of Parliament, to create a meaningful opposition to the status quo. But then when Jeremy Corbyn becomes Labour leader, they start saying, oh, now we have our guy as the Labour Party leader. Maybe everything we thought was wrong. Maybe we can win an election and we can have our guy as the Prime Minister. So everything that you think and know to be true just goes out of the window and you get sort of sucked into the noise. And there is this sort of, not for me actually, but there is this sort of glamour around Parliament and members of Parliament. And you know, aren't they so brave when they stand in the House of Commons and they give this speech? Me and you obviously are not convinced by this sort of thing. But many people are, and they think that this is the most effective way to achieve power in this country, even if they have rationally thought it through. So it's difficult to sort of mobilize when you have this fickle, even wet thinking among many people who ought to know better.
I totally agree with that. And I think part of the solution is that we need to make organizations that have a clearer, sharper set of politics that we cultivate together collectively, and, you know, a praxis, so-called, right? A theory and a practice. So we need to really engage in rigorous theoretical critique of everything, like really try to understand reality, and then put in place a more revolutionary strategy. I absolutely agree with that. And I think partly that's about finding spaces to embolden each other to engage in a more satisfying approach to politics. And I do think there's a very interesting complex relationship between the economic struggle and the political struggle. And you see that with these big trade unions, and then there's the struggle for democracy within trade unions. It's almost always the case that the members of a trade union and the ordinary workers in a workplace are more militant than what their trade union bureaucracy will allow. And then that creates complicated questions, because in this country, obviously, we have some smaller so-called base unions that are much more members-led. And coming back to Palestine, they've mostly been pretty terrible on Palestine, right? So no easy answers for you, but it does seem as though remaining grounded in the economic struggle and thinking about what some people call economic democracy, right? The idea that more than anything, people should have control over their workplaces. And when you think about voting, this very bourgeois understanding of democracy that every 5 years you get to have a vote for which shade of capitalist is going to dominate you. Like, the far more important vote that ordinary people can make in their lives is a vote to go on strike. Like, and you see it. I've been involved in contributing to strike campaigns, and it's incredible to see the transformation in people whenever they realize, like, what, we can vote to withdraw our labor, and if we do, we will gain control of our workplaces. It's stunning. It's
although this is entry level stuff, I should also say, and people engaging in trade unions is one thing, but that isn't, I would say, the real struggle. There has to be a broader consciousness building through engagement with theory and also a practical application of that theory when the opportunity arises. I mean, we often hear about the shock doctrine, which is used to implement neoliberalism. Well, I think we need our own shock doctrine. We're not as effective as other political actors in taking advantage of crises to implement our politics. I don't think we've done that as effectively as we should have been in almost 2 years of genocide in Gaza. And on that note, we have to take a break, but we'll see you for part two of Attrition very shortly. Welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi, and I'm delighted to be joined today by the campaigning barrister, Frank McGuinness. Frank, we were just discussing how anti-imperialists often fail to take advantage of political crises to advance the cause, and we've seen that with Gaza, haven't we?
That's absolutely correct. And it's a sign of how weak the left is. And I was talking about this earlier. The international brigades, right, used to be, and there's a very interesting history of the Spanish Civil War, but broadly it's clear that there was a fight against fascism, and the left sent a load of people to join the fight against fascism. And you compare that to Gaza, like, it's absolutely a fight against fascism. Like, whatever else people might have wanted Zionism to become, it's clear that it's become fascist. If it wasn't, some people would say it was always fascist, but certainly it's undeniably fascist now. You have government ministers like Smotrich just openly saying, yes, I'm a fascist. And where is the left? And that's not some, there's a risk of that becoming this moral chastising, chiding, like, oh, why is the left not better? Like, that's voluntarism, right? I'm not here to say we should be better, we should be stronger. It's like, we're not strong, we're weak, and we should admit that. The left in the so-called West, in the global North, and in developed countries is extremely weak. You're right to say that in this country it was smashed. The miners' strike is perhaps the most obvious example of that, right? one of the most militant trade unions in the country was violently attacked by police forces that Thatcher bussed in from around the country to physically confront organized labor, and she won. And then she her government consolidated that victory in the form of the 92.
Well, that example you mentioned there about the Battle of Orgreave, and there were many other examples, not just that one, of the British police violently attacking striking miners during the miner strike of the 1980s. It relates to a question I wanted to ask, which is that if the concept of terrorism started with this idea that the state has a monopoly on violence, we're now in a position where the state has gained a monopoly on what is legitimate political expression. And so in many ways, you could say, well, they've always had that. You know, the miner strike obviously is a great example of how when people are engaging in a form of protest, which is what striking is, it's a form of protest in order to achieve a particular demand, they were then obviously violently attacked. But we've now seen non-violent political activity in the case of the Prescription of Palestine Action come under the purview of terrorism. So surely that's a clear example of the whole terrorism apparatus being completely fallacious. I mean, can you speak about broadly what this means? Because obviously this is an escalation. It's the first time since the Terrorism Act 2000 came about that a non-violent direct action group has been prescribed. And of course, there's now a judicial review, which is a type of legal process that's been brought against the British government to try to overturn that ban. I appreciate that you're not directly involved in that judicial review, but could you explain what that's about? Because this is a live issue that people should be continuing to campaign on.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on this. So I think that the British state looks incredibly weak right now. It is, of course, responsible. The British Empire passed the Balfour Declaration, presided over the colonial Palestine mandate, used its control of that mandate to facilitate the emergence of the so-called Jewish state, and is therefore more than any other state responsible for the emergence of the Zionist entity and the ongoing project of ethnically cleansing Palestine, right? And it's worth noting that it was British imperialists who first fantasized about this idea of a Jewish state, right? And I've talked before about Andreas Malm's pamphlet, The Destruction of Palestine is the Destruction of the Earth, very thoughtful analysis. And he talks about 1840, right? 1840, the British Navy was bombing Acre on the Mediterranean coast. And so it's almost 200 years as the Brits fantasizing about having a little loyal Jewish Ulster, right? That's Ronald Thor's infamous phrase, right? When he was the colonial governor of Jerusalem. And so the British state has always been committed to Zionism, and it derives a certain degree of military, diplomatic, and sort of strategic benefit from having this unsinkable aircraft carrier. The baton has very much passed to the Yanks now. Like, it went through the French. So it was an interesting period. The French obviously helped the Zionist entity develop a nuclear bomb. And then, I think, around about the 70s, it sort of passes to the US being the main broker of the Zionist entity. And so it seems clear that, you know, so-called Israel can't really survive without a proper, you know, what's sometimes called great power backer, right? They need a really powerful imperialist metropole to support them, without which they wouldn't survive. And you see that from even just this war on Iran, right? They start a war on Iran, an aggressive war on Iran, and then Iran says, you know, we're not, like, we're the biggest regional hegemon, really, and we've got a lot of ballistic missiles. In a war of attrition, we've got 90 million people, and you've got, what, like, less than a tenth of that. And we all saw it. We all saw Israel getting hammered by these missiles slamming into Tel Aviv and Haifa, and it took the US intervening to save Israel. So everyone saw it. It's like, if there were any illusions about it now, Iran was like, in a straight-up conflict between Israel and Iran, Iran wins, absent nuclear weapons, which is an interesting...
Thank you very much, Frank, for joining me. See you on the next one.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا أو يهو بليس استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, it's now time for a short lecture by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani. In this session, he delves into the teachings of the Book for the Hadith by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This book is a profound exploration of ethical and mystical concepts in Islamic spirituality. Let's listen and reflect together.
We were discussing the topic of at-tafakkur in the words of the late Imam al-Khomeini. So going back to the points that we were making, Islam is way ahead of these other philosophies and religions that we find around us in today's world. While you respect everyone, you respect their faith, there's no doubt about it, yes? You can even collaborate with them. But the reality is, when it comes to a theological level, you disagree. It's not even so much of a comparison. Why? Because this religion, and most religions will have this categorization, that a religion is supposed to have these three parts. It's supposed to have your belief system. It's supposed to have your akhlaqiyat. And it's supposed to have your day-to-day rulings. These three categories of every religion, it is only Islam that offers all three of these categories. Where do you find this in other religions? Look at the five major religions in the world today. Yes? Hinduism, Buddhism, which is less of a religion, more of a philosophy of how to live your life, yes? Then you have Judaism and you have Christianity and you have Islam. Where does Judaism come close to what Islam has to offer? Where does Christianity come close to what Islam has to offer? Where does the Jewish faith show you how to live your life in a way that can be traced back to the time of Musa alayhi salam? Yes, it's very easy for a group of people to come together and say, this is how you're supposed to live your life. But can you trace it back to the time of your prophets? Can you trace it back to the time of Musa and say, this is how Musa used to live, so now you have to live this way? And this is exactly what Islam has. Where do we know, for example, about the life of Isa alayhi salam? Yes? If I want to follow Isa alayhi salam in my life, I want to live like Isa alayhi salam, how much do I even know about the life of Isa alayhi salam? The reality is we know very little about the life of Isa alayhi salam. Within the Islamic faith, within the Christian faith, what do we know about his life? When do we know when exactly he was born? And do we know what cities he visited during his prophethood? And do we know, for example, in what house he used to live? And do we know where they took him to try to crucify him, for example? Do we even know these things? We have no idea about these things. Historically, we have no idea about these things. Yes, scholars of the New Testament will tell you, a lot of these are just guesses. Very, very, you know, you might say educated guesses, but they're guesses. We have no idea about these things. Even within Islam, when it comes to Isa alayhi salam, how much information do we have? Historical information. Very little. Yes, we know that he was a man, greatest prophet of Allah, one of the greatest prophets of Allah. He used to go from one village to another village, from one city to another city. We know that he used to bring a new message compared to what people were used to hearing from the Jewish priests of the time. Yes, we know these things. But if I want to follow Isa alayhi salam in my day-to-day life, where can I find information on Isa alayhi salam? But you come to our prophet? What happened to our prophet? When you come to our prophet, you know when he was born. You know where he lived. You know which areas he visited. You know the city where he lived. You know the ins and outs of that city. You know the wells of Medina. The wells of Medina are recorded in history. What wells existed in this city? Mecca, where is it? Who used to live there? So much more information. You know this prophet, when he wanted to leave his house, what would he do to prepare to leave his house? It's recorded in history. You know that when he wanted to meet with his friends, how would he go to meet with his friends? You know which cities he went to visit, which battles he took part in, which battles he couldn't take part in. He sent a group to take part in those battles. You know all of this stuff. And hence you at least have a chance to then do what? To then follow this prophet. But where do you find this in other faiths? Where do you find this in other philosophies? Yes, where do you find this in Hinduism, which is of course a different discussion altogether, in Buddhism, in Judaism, in Christianity? This is not so much of a comparison even, while we respect all faiths, of course. Yes, we respect everybody. But this is a different thing. Imam Khomeini says, if the human being gives a little bit of thought to what Islam is providing versus what other religions have to provide, it wouldn't be so much of a question in his mind. It wouldn't be so much of a difficult decision in his mind. It's very clear. And you move beyond this, probably the most important of all is the fact that Islam has a book that can at least be attributed to the prophets. Now you might have debates, was this book changed, was it not changed, altered, not altered, I don't know, you can have these discussions, yes? But at least you have a text that is attributed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is claimed to be the book that God sent to Muhammad. Salawatullahi alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad wa ajid fanajah. Do you have this when it comes to other religions? Can you even trace the Old Testament back to the time of Musa alayhi salam? Do we even know who wrote this book? No. Historically, you can't even make that claim. When it comes to the New Testament, is the New Testament and the Bible as a whole, is it a book from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to Isa alayhi salam? No. The Bible is not a book from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to Isa alayhi salam. The Bible is a book about Isa alayhi salam. There is a world of difference between those two. It's a world of difference between those two. Imagine if you came across a book, it was a biography of our prophets. If that, the Bible is not that, but if that. That's very different. Saying this book is a book that is the message that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent upon the prophet. He is speaking and the tone is the tone of God speaking to mankind. Is that the case with the Bible? No, not at all. It's not even the case. It doesn't matter if you're Muslim, Christian, it doesn't matter. You would agree on this. Yes, in the Christian faith, of course, you believe that it is inspired by the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that it carries the values of Isa alayhi salam, that all of these things, and these are all good and wonderful. But in reality, does it come close to even what the Qur'an is? No, it doesn't even come close to what the Qur'an is. And this is why sometimes it is a interesting realization for many of us, that when the Qur'an says that Isa alayhi salam had an Injil, we gave them Torah and Injil, and you and I assume that that Injil is this Bible, except this Bible has alterations in it. This is our assumption. So this is the same book, but some things in it were changed. Whereas the reality is, no Christian even claims that this book is the book of Isa alayhi salam. This is a book that speaks a little bit about Isa alayhi salam. Where is this Injil? Where is the book of Isa alayhi salam? Nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. This is a common misunderstanding we have as Muslims. We conflate what the Quran speaks of as Injil with the Bible today. We say they're the same, except there were some changes. No, no. Injil of Isa alayhi salam was lost in history. It's gone. Yes, some of the message, things that were passed on from generation to generation, have made its way, of course, into this Bible that we have today. And it's interesting that even some of the stories that we have in the Bible today are very similar to ahadith that we have from the sixth imam who speaks about the stories of Isa alayhi salam. You will find that they correlate with one another and they coincide with one another many times. Many of the stories are in fact the same. If not many, some of the stories are the same. So you have this book that at least you can look at and say, this is God speaking to mankind. Which other religion has this? Which other faith out there has this? Which other philosophy out there has this? Imam Khomeini says, this is what the Quran or Islam can offer. And hence, if the human being were to think a bit deeper about what Islam can offer to him, it will become very clear to him immediately how Islam has this big advantage.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we
should have done to save humanity. It's too gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. But thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late.
You are listening to Iran Radio, and we are so glad to have you on this part of our schedule. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Let's listen. Islam is the world's second largest religion, and it is a monotheistic faith with about 1.8 billion followers worldwide, originating in Mecca during the life of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Islam means submission to the will of Allah, and its followers are called Muslims. Muslims believe in one God, Allah, who is the creator of all things and has no partners or equals. The Quran is the holy book of Islam, believed to be the literal word of Allah revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Muslims adhere to the five pillars of Islam: Shahada, or declaration of faith; Salah, or prayer; Zakat, or charity; Saum, or fasting during Ramadan; and Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Islamic year is 11 days shorter than the year used in the Western world. This is because the Western year is based on the orbit of the Earth around the Sun instead of on the phases of the Moon. And we'll listen to continuation of Iran Radio. First, we bring you a new edition of Round the World with reporters. Then Radio Productions returns with more engaging content.